This is Audible.
In the early 1960s, Carlos Castaneda was an anthropology student about to graduate when he met an old Yaqui Indian named Juan Matus. With Don Juan as his informant, Castaneda attempted to study the medicinal uses of peyote among the Indians of the southwestern United States and northern Mexico. The old Indian revealed himself as a powerful man of knowledge, a sorcerer, and he took Carlos as his apprentice from the beginning of their relationship. Little by little, the young anthropologist grew into his role as Don Juan's apprentice, and in the 8 books published to date, he has described the different stages of that apprenticeship, sparking a great deal of interest among readers worldwide. Castaneda's works have generated much controversy, especially among anthropologists. Perhaps jealous of the success he has enjoyed, they were disposed to criticize, claiming that his writings have no basis in truth, particularly regarding the existence of Don Juan as a real person. I personally have not had the pleasure of knowing Don Juan, but I do know Don Carlos, and I have read and made use of his books. The question of whether Don Juan existed or not seems to me insignificant in comparison with the ideas set forth in these books. Personally, I'm not particularly interested if the ideas came from Don Juan or from Castaneda. The fact is they exist, and most important, they work. Putting these teachings into practice reveals that in each one of us there lies hidden another awareness, the awareness of the other self, which opens unlimited possibilities of perception and experience. This is what is really significant. The origin of the vision of the world of Don Juan Matus is rooted in the mysterious, although it is evident that it contains a multi-ethnic substratum and shares many of its significant elements with the indigenous world of Mesoamerica, particularly the Toltec universe. Concepts such as Tonal and Nagual, the other self, the dreamed, the earth as a conscious being, are still used and practiced by the indigenous peoples of our time, almost at the dawn of the year 2000. For Don Juan Matus, the existing world is not composed of objects as we see them, but is made up of fields of energy that he terms the eagle's emanations. These fields compose, in fact, the only transcendental reality. These emanations are grouped into great clusters or bands, each making up an independent world. Don Juan speaks of the existence of 48 great bands of emanations, two of which are accessible to humans through our ordinary perception. One of these is the band of organic life. The second is a band that includes structures without consciousness, presumably minerals, gases, liquids, and so forth. Inside the band of emanations of organic beings exists a strip relating in particular to the band of humanity, which determines the narrow limits of the perception of the known. The emanations normally aligned are known as normal awareness, the tonal, the right side. The emanations lying beyond the band of humanity constitute the unknown proper, and as such are never aligned in the context of ordinary life. They are known as the Nagual, a separate reality, the left side. Part of the work of Don Juan and his group of warriors was devoted to developing the ability to align and perceive these emanations. The factor that determines which emanations will be selected or aligned in a given moment of perception is called the assemblage point. The ultimate goal of the system of knowledge as set forth by Castaneda is to achieve the deliberate movement of the assemblage point to free the self from the confines of ordinary perception. The entire system of Don Juan's teaching is geared toward this goal. It is divided into two areas, the teachings for the right side and the teachings for the left side. Each signifies in its own way the forms of not doing that enable the assemblage point to move, which are known as stalking and dreaming, respectively. The process of skimming the aligned emanations, grouping the appropriate ones while disregarding those deemed unnecessary, thus instilling order and meaning to the perception of objects, is called attention. At the moment of birth, babies do not perceive the world in the same way as do adults. Although surrounded by the same emanations, they have not yet learned to select and organize them as would an adult. This they will have to achieve little by little as they grow and assimilate the description of the world provided by their elders. It will be this description that determines the precise form in which their perception selects and organizes the fields of energy that surround them. It is valid to say that what we perceive daily is the same description flowing constantly from ourselves toward the outside world. The flow of the description is generally constant, sustaining our familiar perception of the world, moment by moment, day after day. If the flow is suspended, our perception of the world collapses, resulting in what is known in the writings of Castaneda as stopping the world. Seeing refers to the capacity to perceive the world as it appears once the flow of the description has been interrupted. The internal dialogue is the mental conversation that we sustain constantly with ourselves and is the most immediate expression of reality assimilated by everyone. We tell ourselves the world is such and so and leave convinced that it is indeed thus. Naturally, all of that which happens as a consequence of the internal dialogue ceases the moment we are able to stop said dialogue. This is why Don Juan speaks of stopping the internal dialogue as the key that opens the door between the worlds. The ability to skim certain aligned emanations to agree with the terms of the description shared by the rest of humanity is called the first ring of power. At the same time, there exists a second ring of power that allows perception to occur outside the ordinary description. This the sorcerer uses to construct other worlds. Although everyone has this second ring, it functions only when the first ring is shut down, a thing that rarely occurs in the life of ordinary people. One way in which the first ring can be blocked is by performing actions foreign to our ordinary description of the world, what is known as not doing. Not doing interrupts the flow of the description, and this interruption in turn suspends the doing of the world of the known. Not doing is the medium that opens the way to the unknown side of reality and of oneself. In other words, it provides access to the Nagual, what is referred to in the case of the world as the separate reality, or in the case of an individual as the awareness of the other self. Another aspect to be considered is that all we refer to when we say I, the ego, is also an element of the description we assimilate. When by means of the not doings of the personal self, we interrupt the flow of the description of our own person, we free ourselves from the enchantment of the ego, which wants us to believe that it represents the only reality. We can recognize then our true nature as fields of energy, free and fluid. Starting from that moment, we can take on the task of reinventing ourselves in an intentional and voluntary fashion, able to respond in novel ways to new situations that each moment provides for us. One of the more all-encompassing aspects of the Don Juanist vision is the dual conception of reality expressed by the terms tonal and nagual. The tonal includes all that a human is, thinks, and does, all that we can think and talk about. Reason, thought, and the ordinary description of reality are the fortress of the tonal, the entire spectrum of the known. It is noteworthy that for an average person there exists only the known, so that all conscious experience is restricted within the confines of the tonal, which begins at birth and ends in death. The Nagual, then, would be all that remaining outside the tonal. It is that about which it is not possible to think. Castaneda presents the tonal as an island upon which is passed the whole of life. No one knows anything about what lies beyond the borders of the island. The Nagual would be all that space of unfathomable mystery surrounding it. Although ultimately everything occurs in the Nagual, which is all-encompassing, the task of the tonal is to endow the reality of the Nagual, the universe of the ego's emanations, with order and meaning, which are not part of transcendental reality. The tonal and the Nagual aspects of the world also have a corresponding expression in every human being, each of whom has a tonal side and a Nagual side. In the work of Castaneda, they are also called awareness of the right side and awareness of the left side, ordinary awareness and awareness of the other self, the dreamer and the dreamed. On the left side, or Nagual, of each person is what is known as the awareness of the other self. Its rescue and reintegration into the reality of a person constitute one of the most commonly recurring themes in the work of Castaneda. In fact, the integration of the awareness of the other self with everyday awareness brings nearer the possibility of integrating the totality of oneself. It should be added here that in the work of Castaneda, the term Nagual is also used to designate the leader of a party of warriors. This is the being who, thanks to an extraordinary level of energy, can generate the appropriate conditions necessary, thus allowing the warriors of the group to move their assemblage points and experience for themselves the separate reality located beyond the narrow confines of the Tonal. The warrior does not exist but is a myth, a beautiful myth of our time that, like all other myths, works to reflect our most noble aspirations as mortals. Myths are, in part, stories told many times and transmitted from generation to generation. Anthropologically speaking, it would be absurd to question whether these tales are real or fictional. Myths are real insofar as they serve a real function among the people of a society. In its myths, a nation finds a mirror that reflects its best face, and even its unknown face, the face of the other. That other that I am, and nevertheless am not. That other that I am not, yet dream to be. That other who is a reflection of myself, yet different, elevated, transfigured, converted into a being with power, magic, and above all, freedom. The myth is to society what dreams are to the individual. Therefore, the myth represents the dream of human beings, which whispers in their ear the promise of beauty and liberty. Among so-called primitive peoples, myth and ritual are intimately linked. The rite or ceremony represents the time outside of time. It is the space in which its participants will be transformed, incarnating the magic beings about which their songs and legends speak. This is the magic time in which the beings of power, light, love, and knowledge return to Earth to take on human form, the time in which humans convert themselves into the magic beings they dream to be. For ourselves, the myth of the warrior is a marvelous invitation for its incarnation to become real within us. The attitude of a warrior begins by bringing a little of that magic time into our everyday lives. In place of acting like machines pre-programmed from outside, we choose to act purposefully in the manner of a warrior. These moments of enlightenment in which we direct our lives from inside are like the magic time of a ceremony in which life speaks to us personally and we understand it, in which life becomes a friend. Don Juan said in Castaneda's first book that a man goes to knowledge the same way he goes to war, with fear, respect, wakefulness, and with absolute confidence. Therefore, those who go to knowledge could very well be called warriors. The way of the warrior of which Castaneda speaks has little or nothing to do with human wars such as we know them, principally because it has nothing to do with violence or the intent to destroy anything or anyone. Far from it, in fact. This is perhaps difficult to understand in a culture such as ours, where the word war signifies one of the most frequent activities of civilized societies, whether it be on an individual or social level, and where it always refers to the intent to impose our will on others through subtle or outright violence. The Don Juan's point of view of the warrior and the struggle to be free is an example of a different type of war, one in which the warrior wants to rescue the possibility to choose how to be and how to live. It is a struggle for harmony and tranquility. It is a struggle for freedom, knowing that the struggle begins inside, projecting itself from there toward everything that makes up the world of actions. It is a quiet, gentle, and joyful fight. Anything that we do can be done in a manner of a warrior. A warrior is always in an unyielding state of total war, leaving no room for negligence or surrender. This transforms our smallest acts into a challenge of power to carry us beyond our limits each time, to be better, more powerful, more gentle, more real. Warriors also count on the awareness of their own impending death, performing each act as though it were the last battle, and therefore the best. With death as a constant companion who infuses each act with power, they transform into magic their time as living persons on this earth. The awareness of inevitable death endows them with the disinterest to be free from attachments, while at the same time not indulging in denial. Detached from everything, conscious of life's brevity, and in constant struggle, warriors begin to arrange life through the power of their decisions. The elements that make up the strategy of warriors are the elements of the way with the heart, which allows them to derive enjoyment from each moment of time. Making use of will, control, strategy, and the awareness of impending death, warriors learn to reduce their needs to nothing. Free from need, all that they have and receive, even the smallest, simplest items, become marvelous gifts. And life, regardless of how much is left to them, remains in a permanent state of abundance. As has been mentioned, for Don Juan as well as his apprentice Carlos, the world is not made up of solid objects, such as we perceive them, but rather of fields of energy, an idea in accord with the latest theories of modern physics. The idea of energy is one of the fundamental themes of Don Juan's thinking and practice. In The Fire from Within, Castaneda alludes to a central theme that he calls the mastery of awareness. He states that among its essential elements is the fact that we are, in reality, fields of energy, or luminous eggs. Although everyone has energy, we find that average people's energy is totally consumed in the routine acts of their lives, as determined entirely by their past. All of our energy in ordinary life is already invested within the confines of the known, leaving nothing for the exploration of the unknown. This is the reason for the enormous difficulty facing an ordinary person wishing to change or to create situations distinct from those that make up the normal in his or her life. There is no energy available. On the other hand, anything undertaken on the path of knowledge will necessarily be concerned with energy. Warriors know that to venture into the unknown, with all the changes to be made, requires not only a high level of energy, but also a high level of available energy. Warriors know that each act either fortifies or weakens their energy, and become very careful about the nature of their actions, striving always for impeccability, the optimum use of energy. The key to the matter is this. If we stop perceiving ourselves as egos, accepting instead that we are fields of energy, then not only will we have to change the way we view reality, our way of behaving in it will tend to change as well. As egos, we feel compelled to defend and reaffirm an enormous number of actions in the name of the ego. As fields of energy, on the other hand, our attention must be placed on how we use that energy, on whether it is increasing or decreasing. Therefore, our actions will tend to orient themselves toward the appropriate use of energy. Impeccability, known also as the seal of a warrior. As a simple and concrete example, take the case of a man whose ego reacts with frustration and anger because his wife did not have dinner ready when he got home from work. As an ego, he feels offended, since the ego demands worship and that everyone take as the truth all that he believes about himself. Therefore, he will yell and threaten his wife, looking for acceptance that the very important ego of her husband deserves to be treated with more consideration. If he gets it, she will cry or beg forgiveness, or she will prepare dinner in a state of hurry and anguish. In a covert way, she will be expressing to the ego of her husband, not his real self, "Yes, I believe you exist and you are real. I also believe everything you say and tell me about yourself is true." The man in our story would proceed in a different way if he were to perceive himself as a field of energy. As such, his first concern would entail the optimum use of his energy. He would know that anger consumes an enormous amount of energy while contributing nothing, save weakness, bad health, and poor quality of life, factors that do not constitute appropriate or desirable use of his energy. Thus, in place of uselessly wasting his energy, he will consider his options, waiting quietly while dinner is prepared or perhaps assisting in its preparation. Everything living beings do and everything that happens to them is determined by their level of energy or personal power. Most of the time, ordinary people believe that the events of their life are determined by factors that are out of their control. Because the events are physically removed from them, or because they are supposedly characteristic, intrinsically part of a person or ego. The thinking of Don Juan is very different. Everything that happens to us depends on our personal power, and whether we have it or not depends entirely on ourselves. Good or bad health, good or bad luck, available affection and love, doors open for us, doors which remain closed. Basically, we can say that those who possess a high degree of energy lead sound, healthy lives, unless their energy is out of control, while the lives of those with a low energy level, the majority of humanity, will often be gray and painful. It would not be an exaggeration to say that those who have energy can accomplish anything, while those who lack it will always be poor, even though they may be swimming in material wealth. The form in which an ordinary person utilizes energy is not a product of chance or of choice. Rather, it is determined by his or her past. Although we modern people like very much to consider ourselves free, in reality our possibilities of making a free choice are limited to only a very small part of our actions. Putting aside for the moment all functions and activities connected with biological conditioning, we find that the total remaining actions are determined entirely by personal history. Social class, nationality, sex, personality, religion, political ideology, complexes, and traumas are only some examples of the many details that make up our personal history, thereby determining the what and the how of our daily existence. In reality, when we believe that we decide, we are doing nothing more than setting in motion actions that have already been programmed into us by our past. However, although normally men and women consume all of their energy performing the routines dictated by their personal history, it is possible for them to make the following fundamental changes in their condition as fields of energy. Redirect energy, save energy, increase energy. The possibility of redirecting energy seemingly contradicts what was established earlier, that our energy use is already predetermined by our past. If the use of our energy is predetermined, then how can this be changed? In reality, such a change is possible, although rare. The contradiction is resolved in practice. Practice begins with a form of specialized conduct, actions that from the point of view of the ego are completely out of the ordinary. Through persisting in the performance of unusual acts, we create a disruption in the habitual patterns of our energy use, and as a consequence, they begin to loosen. Once this loosening process begins, we are in a better position to redirect the energy formerly spent in consuming activities toward new, much more worthwhile pursuits. However, if we occupy ourselves only with the redirection of energy, without making an effort to save or increase it, we will achieve only limited results. And if in order to accumulate energy, we must have a supply of available energy, how can we obtain this primal energy? The answer is, we can save it. That's it. The way for human beings to obtain free energy is to save what they already have by not spending it on the routines of everyday life. The method is simple, but its effects are far-reaching. If we suspend some of our internal or external repetitive actions, the energy thus liberated becomes available energy, which we can use to enter into the unknown, that which lies outside the dictates of personal history. However, not all the actions of life can be suspended, and among those that can, not all are energy wasting. This is why warriors make an inventory of energy expenditures. That allows them to know, through the technique of stalking, how they use their energy, and later to plan a strategy for redirecting its use. Thereby, they increase their available energy. From this inventory, apprentices can choose from their everyday activities those that are not indispensable for life, and that are particularly wasteful and destructive, anti-energetic, to work for their temporal or definitive removal. As average people, we cannot, of course, immediately suspend such habits as smoking, anger, or self-pity. We can, however, change small things, such as our sleeping position, or perhaps sleep on the floor. We can, for instance, observe for 2 weeks our first thought upon waking in the morning, and our last thought before going to sleep at night. If we discover, as is usually the case, that they have a negative influence on our energy, then during the next 2 weeks we can intentionally change these thoughts and think something different. Working with an inventory of energy expenditures, it is possible to discover many small activities that allow us, right from the beginning, to save energy. Once this process has begun, the energy thus saved allows us to amplify our efforts to include a wider range of habits that were inaccessible earlier, precisely due to a lack of energy. In this way, energy brings energy. Examples of energy-consuming habits include smoking, alcoholism, arguing, oversleeping, excessive thinking, judging others, criticism, condemning, complaining, identification with violent fantasies such as those seen on television, movies, or in the newspaper. It is important to note that everything that applies to human beings in relation to personal power applies to all living beings, since they are all fields of energy. Don Juan often referred to the existence of magical animals whose magic made them practically invulnerable. They were not likely to be captured by hunters. Their power was derived from the fact that, unlike ordinary animals, they had no routines. This endowed them with lightness, freedom, and extraordinary power. He said it would be fortunate indeed to encounter one of these beings. In the same way, what happens among plants and animals also occurs among humans. Those who achieve a life free of routines and who have a high degree of energy transform themselves by right into magical beings who at the least do not follow the rules that govern the lives of the average person. Rather, they rule their lives, destinies, and circumstances by this special power that is at their service, but that they also inexorably must serve. In order to save energy, we must begin to understand how and on what we normally spend it, which will allow us to later formulate a strategy for saving it. Therefore, an inventory is the first technique we must practice, as a foundation for all the rest. To do such an inventory, the following materials will be required: a pen or pencil, a notebook, and some kind of signal, such as an alarm. Divide the pages of the notebook into three columns, heading them with the following questions in this order. What was I thinking? What was I doing? Is this what I want to do? Set the alarm to sound every 15 minutes. Each time the alarm sounds, observe yourself in that moment, and then respond in your notebook to the three questions. Don't analyze, simply record what you observe. Remember that the exercise of observation has to do with registering facts, not analyzing them. So be as coldly objective as possible when answering the questions. Before going to sleep, review what you wrote down during the day and respond in writing on a separate sheet of paper to the following questions. Were my thoughts varied or repetitive? What were the most often recurring elements in my thoughts? Were my actions varied or repetitive? Which ones were the most repetitive? Was there a relation between my thoughts and my actions? What percentage of my actions had anything to do with what I really wanted to do? Answering these questions from the point of view of stalking will give you an idea of how you used your energy that day. With this information, make the most detailed list possible of external actions, activities, routines, physical habits, addictions, etc., and internal experiences, repetitive thoughts, emotional habits, illnesses, states of being, etc., that make up your life. The resulting list becomes your inventory of energy expenditures. Now divide the elements of the list into two columns. The first column should contain that which is indispensable to sustain life: eating, sleeping, breathing, etc. The second column, that which is not indispensable to sustain life: anger, criticism, jogging, drawing, etc. The criteria we use to define what is indispensable is highly subjective. Therefore, we should use our own criteria without too much worry. Divide the elements from the second column into two more columns: that which makes me feel well and that which does not make me feel well. Again, feel free to be subjective. Next, divide the elements from the second column describing indispensable elements that do not make you feel well into two more columns: that which is not possible to eliminate and that which can be eliminated either without difficulty or by making a small effort. Select from the second column a few elements that you consider appropriate, and during a specific period, cease to perform them. Immediately, the energy that was formerly used for these acts will be converted into extra energy. At the end of your chosen period, decide whether you want to prolong the exercise indefinitely or suspend it. To choose the actions to suspend, we can start with the easiest or with the most energy-consuming. It all depends on how intensely we are willing to work. It is important to determine beforehand the exact length of time a given activity is to be suspended, and it is best to make it short in the beginning. It is too taxing psychologically to think of quitting something forever. To leave it for a few days is much easier. It also permits us to periodically evaluate our results and to decide whether or not to continue with the task. Considering the importance of the wise expenditure of energy, it is vital to determine the energetic quality of your acts. To accomplish this, take a few moments to observe your body and sensations, or your spirit, after performing an act whose energetic quality you wish to know. The answer will be clear. If you feel good, vigorous, happy, and full, the act is energizing. If you feel weak, spent, out of sorts, and empty, the act is energy-consuming. Finally, many techniques exist for saving energy and well-being. I will mention two. First, practice strictly for a period of 3 days or more this golden rule. Don't criticize, don't condemn, don't complain. Once the period is over, either begin another or wait a while before beginning again. Second, practice the technique of silence. Given that much energy is consumed in talking, stopping this activity can be very beneficial, especially for those who love to talk. Now let us move on to a discussion of the art of stalking and the separate reality. According to the Don Juan's vision of reality, there exists a separate reality that is parallel with our ordinary reality. In general terms, the perceptual velocity needed to be able to perceive this separate reality can only be achieved by a movement of the assemblage point. The separate reality invites the warrior to freedom, It offers new worlds full of mystery, in which each being can experience itself in unsuspected ways. Don Juan outlines two general ways in which to achieve movement of the assemblage point, the art of dreaming and the art of stalking. First, we will deal with the art of stalking, which takes place within the reality of the everyday world. It is practice in right-side awareness. That is, it consists of an extremely careful and specialized handling of ordinary reality, with its final aim the penetration into this separate reality. The term stalking naturally reminds us of hunting. The stalker is one who observes, one in whom stealth forms an integral part of conduct. A hunter is necessarily a stalker, although only warriors would be able to apply this technique to every aspect of their life, converting its every element, including self and personal weakness, into their prey. The true hunter, as well as the stalker, well knows the difference between judgment and observation, between paying attention and thinking. If we wish to trap prey, we must first observe it. We must silently perceive what the prey does in order to know its routines, where it eats, when and what time it sleeps, its movements, and so forth. If our observation is effective, we will become familiar with these routines, allowing us to later devise a trap against them. The average person, unable to distinguish between thoughts and reality, confounds observation with judgment. We pass through life thinking things, generally negative, about the people around us or about ourselves, and this we call observation. The observation of the hunter, however, has nothing to do with criticism. Imagine for a moment what would occur if hunters, instead of observing the prey silently, began to speculate about its qualities or defects, judging it as beautiful or ugly, interesting or boring. When hunters observe, there is no room for thought or internal dialogue. Everything is direct and simple. Merely observe what is there. Observation is one of the basic elements upon which the art of stalking is constructed. Another one is unusual behavior. In The Fire from Within, Don Juan tells us that the internal dialogue itself, together with everyday conduct, is what keeps the assemblage point fixed in one place. Then, any unusual conduct, if practiced continuously and systematically, tends to move it out of this habitual position. According to Don Juan, recapitulation is the stronghold of stalkers in the same way that dreaming constitutes the stronghold of dreamers, and it can be considered the basic practice that makes one into a stalker. Recapitulation is a natural act. It is the last act of living beings just before the disintegration of their individuality, which is death. It happens to everyone just before the moment of death. People reviving after being declared clinically dead often report that their whole life passed before them. Castaneda states that once the body has completed its final recapitulation, a burst of total awareness occurs that lasts only for an instant before death itself, or what he calls the moment in which the ego consumes the awareness of the dying person. For only an instant, thanks to recapitulation, at the moment of death, we become pure awareness. Stalkers have a very keen interest in the super-awareness derived from recapitulation, and they ask, why wait for the moment of death to recapitulate? Why not recapitulate before and make use of its power to change our lives now? This is precisely why recapitulation forms the basis of stalking. I want to make clear that recapitulation does not refer to ordinary memory. Recapitulation is the not doing of memory. While ordinary memories deal only with thoughts, recapitulation is more like a sense memory having to do with feelings. When we remember, it is the ego remembering by means of the internal dialogue, to which we add images. In recapitulation, on the other hand, it is the body remembering, and it does so by liberating the feelings stored within it. The vast majority of us are tied to our past, which is to be expected, since it provides the support that the ego uses to justify itself. The past determines what we are, and makes us feel justified in maintaining our everyday behavior, even though we may be aware that it is not good for us. A large part of our time is spent remembering the past. Only we don't realize that what we are remembering is not reality, but rather images fabricated by our internal dialogue concerning what happened to us. We don't remember facts, but interpretations of facts. We are unaware of our real past because we are too involved in repeating to ourselves a mythical history that our ego has developed to justify its existence. Nevertheless, The awareness of what we have lived and done is not totally lost. We possess an alternate memory hidden in the awareness of our other self, which has nothing to do with the interpretations of the ego, and which it is possible to recover. Recapitulation is a bodily experience contained in the totality of our being that allows us to relive the feelings implicit in the events being recapitulated. The information it provides generally does not coincide with what our ordinary mental memory says about our own existence. From this, it can be deduced that recapitulation also represents a doorway to freedom. If we can know directly, without interpretations, how this ego was formed, what things we renounced, what promises from the past we secretly drag along behind, how it is that we come to believe who we believe we are, if we are capable of perceiving ego as a description fabricated during past stages of life, which therefore is not as real or definite as we had previously supposed, then it means we are capable of change. It means we are not condemned by this vulgar history called our past. This implies that if we know what our structured routines are, then we have the necessary information for determining which not-doings would be the most appropriate for dismantling them, for erasing our personal history. We can then choose how to live and how to be, in what type of world we wish to live. We can abandon repetition and boredom and replace them with magic, amazement, and joy. The most important effect of recapitulation is increasing our energy. In the multiple interactions we have with other human beings, we experience painful moments in which we lose parts of our luminosity. Particularly in a strong emotional exchange, we experience a great loss of energy as complete parts of our luminosity fall off and are left behind. After such interactions, we will feel incomplete, secretly feeling we lack something, although we are not sure what it is. Using Don Juan's terminology, we would say that holes form in our luminous egg through which energy is continually being drained and wasted, thus weakening our equilibrium and power. That these energy holes are a constant drain can be observed in the lives of average people. There is a tendency to repeat the debilitating routines that began with some painful emotional exchange, that is, starting from the formation of one of these holes. A common example of this happens in the separation of lovers. The abandoned partner feels as though a part of the self is lost. There is a physical pain in the umbilical region of the abdomen. This is not allegorical. Recapitulation permits the recovery of energy lost along the way by providing us with the means to plug the holes in our luminosity. There are many ways to recapitulate, while buried in the earth, with the help of trees, with another person, in a group, through massage, or through physical movements in a group. The basic procedure for recapitulation is presented to us by Castaneda in The Eagle's Gift, recapitulating inside a box. This is the most efficient and complete technique for general recapitulation. It is a systematic procedure to help the body to remember, and in this way to achieve a general recapitulation of your life. Using a box for recapitulation requires three elements: a list of events to recapitulate, special breathing techniques, and the recapitulation box. In theory, the list of events to be recapitulated should include all the events of our existence, beginning with the moment in which stalkers begin writing the list and finishing with their birth or before. Recapitulation can include prenatal experiences. Naturally, such a list would contain a practically inexhaustible number of events. The universe of our past would be too enormous to be functional. In practice, we begin to work first with the most significant events and those that spring readily to mind. Don Carlos himself suggests that we recapitulate our life by dividing it into areas. This extremely simple method consists of the following steps. Select three areas of your life to recapitulate. Divide each area into its component elements. Divide each element into stages. And divide each stage into its specific events. Choose areas that have to do with things or activities that have been with you for a good share of your life. Typical examples would include houses in which I have lived, love relationships, my family, my friends, my work, schools. The important thing is to be able to break the chosen area down into its elements. Choosing houses would be of little value if you have lived in only one house your entire life, or choosing lovers if you have never had one. The number of events in each stage can vary greatly. A well-made list might have from 300 to 2,000 events, or even more. The time and attention you spend making your list will afford proportionally superior results. Generally, this will take 2 to 12 weeks minimum, working frequently. Having one area completed is usually enough to begin using the recapitulation box. A list with 3 areas well chosen and finished can be considered rather complete. Breathing is the magic element in the process of recapitulation, through which you can direct the repairs your body will have to make to its energetic structure. There are 3 types of breathing: inhalation, exhalation, and the complete breath. Inhalation is the principal respiration in the exercise of recapitulation. Respiration number 1. Its central element, as its name indicates, is inhaling. It is the respiration that pulls, that attracts. It is used during 2 specific moments, when beginning a session of recapitulation inside the box, and when during the session we find an experience in which we lost energy, some experience that left us incomplete. Effects of this respiration permit the practitioner to pass from simple remembering to recapitulation proper. To accomplish this, you must be relaxed in both body and mind. The spinal column must be straight, eyes closed. Begin by facing forward with the lungs empty. Without inhaling, turn your head until it faces over your right shoulder. Starting from there, rotate 180 degrees until you are facing over the left shoulder, all the while taking in a deep, slow breath until your lungs are completely filled with air. Both movement and breathing should be slow and synchronized. From the left shoulder, hold the air while turning to face forward, then slowly exhale, and you are back at the starting point. Make an almost imperceptible pause between each one of the movements. This can be done whenever and as often as you feel is necessary, although generally a few minutes are enough. Exhalation is the reverse of the first, and its purpose is to separate or detach. It is used during recapitulation when we find an experience in which filaments from other people become attached to our own luminosity, or when we encounter a promise we wish to be rid of. Respiration number 2 liberates the body of foreign filaments and of promises that no longer need be honored. It is done in the same position and with the conditions indicated in number 1, only in reverse. Begin by facing forward, inhaling slowly. Holding the air, turn to face over the left shoulder. Once there, slowly rotate your head 180 degrees while exhaling completely, until you are facing over the right shoulder. Lungs empty of air, you turn to face forward again to the starting position. Your body will tell you, through feeling, when to stop. Also, the same slowness of movement, synchronization between breathing and movement, and pauses are observed as in respiration number 1. The complete breath is used when we wish to clarify a scene from our past, to recover our sobriety, or simply when we want better concentration. A complete description of it will be given later in this program. Now let us turn to the recapitulation box. The box is a very powerful element in aiding recapitulation. It is both a tool and a symbol. As a tool, it helps the body to remember. As a symbol, it represents the limits of personal history in which we are held prisoners, the limits of the ego. The recapitulation box, as its name implies, is a box, generally made of wood, which must be built while the person intending to use it is in a state of total concentration. Basically, it has the shape of a cube, with one of its 6 sides fitted with hinges to function as a door. It need not form a perfect cube, but it must be constructed in such a way as to reduce the space around the body to no more than 2 inches at its closest approach. Its shape should permit the practitioner to enter and sit down with the back straight and the legs crossed or drawn up against the chest to make the body as compact as possible. Allowance must also be made for adequate ventilation, while at the same time reducing light entry to a minimum. Other materials can be used, but wood is the best by virtue of the favorable influence that trees and tree products have on people. It is best not to paint or draw designs on the box or to build it in a form other than the basic cube. Pyramids, for instance, besides provoking all sorts of metaphysical interpretations, produce a different effect, one that might well be disturbing. The use of metal parts, nails, hinges, etc., should be reduced to a minimum. Any glue used should be organically based. Again, as with the list, the more time and concentration spent in fabricating the box, the more effective it will be in aiding us in our task. Now that your list is ready, you are familiar with the 3 methods of breathing, and your box is constructed, you can go to work. Before entering the box, you must examine the most recent events on the list and memorize them in order to recall them once you are in the box. Inside the box, you will be concerned only with the fourth column from your list, the events. The number of events chosen should be no more than you consider possible to recapitulate in a single session. Theoretically, you should recapitulate one by one the events on the list, beginning with the most recent and ending with the most remote. I say theoretically because in practice, when the body recapitulates, it takes its own direction that often is not according to the order of the list. Sometimes events will appear that are not on the list, and some you thought were very important pass to second place. Once inside the box, begin practicing respiration number one for a few minutes. Each of you will have to determine for yourself the exact time required for this. The events will begin to arise by themselves. However, you can help by making a conscious effort to remember. There is no harm if you begin by using ordinary memory. In fact, the effort you put into making your list, the special breathing, and the box all combine to aid you in passing from ordinary memory to recapitulation. You can also try less obvious ways to remember. For example, focus your attention on more minor aspects of a given event instead of its central theme. If, for instance, the memory is about a discussion, what were some of the details in the room? What color were the walls? Try to remember the feelings that were present rather than the words that were spoken. Body sensations are very useful. What did I feel in my knees? How did my feet feel? My stomach? What odors were present? Once the process has begun, use the breathing exercises as necessary. 1, to recover energy. 2, to detach foreign filaments and to liberate yourself from promises and decisions no longer relevant to your life. And 3, to recover clarity and sobriety. Once all the events on the list have been recapitulated, you must dispose of your box in a personal ritual that expresses the moment in which you have finally freed yourself from the confines of your personal history. The details of the ritual are strictly personal. The box should be burned or buried. Recapitulation is best done during the hours when most people are asleep, so as to be free of their extraneous thoughts. Also, doing it in an unpopulated area will enhance the experience. Outdoors among trees is even better. Preferably, the box should be left in one place for the entire duration of the exercise. This lends an air of ritual to the experience. However, ideal conditions for recapitulation are not mandatory. The important thing is to do it, no matter where. While recapitulating, let your feelings flow freely. If you are in a place where you cannot cry, yell, or laugh, it would be better to look for a more isolated place. Also, you should avoid calling excessive attention to your box and/or the exercise, especially to those who are totally unprepared to understand what these exercises are all about. If someone should ask about it, simply say that it is my meditation box or some such thing. Any attention from outsiders about your work can create obstacles for you. Now let us turn to the area of intending appearances. Working with appearances is another technique of stalking, one that can be as fun as it can be devastating. It has to do with artistic creation in the most authentic sense. It deals to a certain extent with the art of the actor as well as the art of disguise. The principal characteristic of this technique, in which you disguise yourself and/or act like someone completely different from your everyday self, is not only to convince the spectators, but also to convince yourself to such a degree that the force of your conviction is transmitted to the spectators. This is a modification of perception, a movement of the assemblage point. Carried to its extreme, the art of pure acting is the art of the sorcerer and the Nagual, the art of transformation. What do sorcerers experience when converting into crows and flying away? In principle, they feel as though they fly, feel themselves crows, seeing and experiencing the world as such. Their secret is that they are capable of modifying their perceptions to match that of a crow, modifying the position of their assemblage point. Their knowledge of sorcery, their conviction, and their years of work allow them to achieve it. But now we have a question, one that Castaneda put to Don Juan long ago. What would a spectator see? An average spectator would probably just see a sleeping person and might think him or her drunk or intoxicated. But a spectator in a state of non-ordinary awareness, or one observing a sorcerer of extraordinary power, one who could force, with the power of his or her conviction, the movement of the spectator's assemblage point, surely would see a miracle, a person transformed into a crow and flying away. And Castaneda asked the question again, Was that real, what I felt? To which Don Juan replies, there is no reality other than that which you felt. Reality is a feeling. I have discovered, among other things, that true acting functions as a doorway to the other self, to the experience outside the ego, a quality which by itself would make this a practice worthy of exploration. When you convert yourself into your personage, when you are capable of moving your perception to become its living expression, your former ego is revealed in its true dimensions, and your old life as well. You realize that the ego and the world in which you once believed you were trapped was only a mirage, just one more character in one more play, with actors who had forgotten they were acting on a stage. This is significant especially when the act in the play you portray is one of pain or boredom. This technique can help a great deal to diminish self-importance, to erase personal history, and to view your everyday life from another perspective. First, you must choose or create a character with very well-defined traits, preferably one with characteristics diametrically opposed to your own. Take time to study the character thoroughly in order to know all details. You have to determine how he or she talks, thinks, feels, dresses, moves, and so forth. Next, prepare your character's entry into the world. Obtain the proper clothing, and begin practicing personal manifestations in private. Attitudes, vocabulary, interests, activities. Go public and interact disguised as your character. You must remain active, go out, converse, visit places, work, according to the role you are playing. It requires a minimum of discipline in order not to slip back into your everyday self. The key is to convince yourself of the role, feel it intimately, and think as the character would, make it a real person. The idea here is to disguise yourself so well that no one is able to recognize you. This, of course, depends not only on a good disguise, but on a good characterization as well. Attitudes, tone of voice, and so forth must all be congruent with the disguise. This should be done so well that not even family members could recognize you. The procedure for this is, 1. Obtain the disguise. 2. Put it on and practice the characterization. 3. Disguised, observe the space in which your ordinary life takes place for a period of at least one day. 4. Interact in that space with the people who know you, but without giving yourself away. This exercise allows you to observe your everyday world, your relationships, the people closest to you, from an unusual perspective. Naturally, your disguise must be effective and appropriate for interacting among the people who know you, who, of course, will consider you a stranger. Play the role of a salesman of religious books, a survey taker, a beggar, or a fireman. Any of these would work. Thus disguised, go to your house, your work, to school, and speak with family members, friends, and acquaintances. The more prolonged your interaction and the more areas of your life you observe, the greater will be your results. This exercise may be practiced as often and as long as you like, but at a minimum, it should be at least one whole day. Also, it can be changed periodically. You can change your disguise on different occasions, or go into more depth with the original character. With this exercise, you must be prepared for surprises where they are least expected. Disguising oneself as a member of the opposite sex is a variation of the preceding exercise that deserves separate mention due to its singular effect. In The Power of Silence, Don Juan tells us that only in a woman's disguise can any man really learn the art of stalking. The exercise consists of disguising yourself, if you're a man, as a woman, so well as to be totally convincing to any observer. It is recommended that you practice it thoroughly in order to have an inkling of what being a woman is like. As a woman practicing this exercise, you would, in a similar manner, disguise yourself as a man and act as such. It should be mentioned that this technique will lose much of its effectiveness if done in a less involving environment, such as among your friends. In order for this exercise to have value, it must be done among strangers who, thanks to your disguise, will really think they are dealing with a woman, in the case of a male stalker, or with a man in the case of a female one. This exercise is one that almost invariably will cause the assemblage point to move. Now we will turn to a discussion of dissolving the ego. Not doing in general is the basic strategy a sorcerer uses to enter into the separate reality, and under which ultimately are grouped the different techniques, such as stalking and dreaming. The not doings of the personal self constitute a specialized area within the totality of the techniques known as stalking. These techniques are understood to be practices specifically designed to dissolve the warrior's ego, as well as his or her ordinary view of the world, two phenomena that, as we already know, are reciprocal. Castaneda describes three principal forms of not-doings of the personal self: using death as an advisor, losing self-importance, and erasing personal history, which is broken down into separate techniques. All of these tend to produce the dissolution of the ego. Such dissolution represents a doorway to freedom for a warrior who has worked to achieve it, and at the same time a doorway to insanity for an average person who may undergo such changes accidentally through an intense emotional crisis. When we say ego, we mean all that is referred to when we say the word I. Just what exactly is this I? We don't really know, but it feels as though it is located in the head, behind the eyes. And what about the body? We feel that the body is not I, but something that I possess for my use. That is, for transport, for showing off to others, and so forth. That's why it is referred to as my body. And what about energy? For example, what about the field of energy that is my being and extends beyond the limits of my skin? No one speaks of that. As average people, we do not, as a rule, even conceive of such a thing, to say nothing of considering this field as part of I. If the ego is not my body or my energy, then what is it? What is it made of? The absurd but true answer is nothing. The ego is a description, nothing else, words, just words. It has no specific reality. This can be proven only through the practice of the not-doings of the personal self. In the doings of everyday life, we are like this or like that. We are capable of some things, but not others. Nevertheless, in practicing not doing, practitioners discover that they are capable of doing many things that were formerly regarded as impossible because they were not contained in the description, and that certainly is good news. We can act outside the description. Essentially, anyone engaged in an act not in agreement with the content of the description that calls itself I is performing a not doing of the personal self. This is indeed possible to carry out. We have all been educated to believe that the ego is our only reality, to believe that that is who we are and will be until the end. We have forgotten we weren't always that way. We have forgotten that once we were without form, which permitted us to be amazed, to feel everything and everyone as a discovery, as a mystery. But we are not condemned to live forever trapped inside a description. We can dissolve ourselves. We can erase our personal history. We can regain our freedom. The phenomenon of psychotic madness deserves a brief commentary. Psychosis has to do with the violent dissolution of reality and the ego. Not that psychotics hallucinate things that do not exist. Rather, they are perceiving things that exist, but they organize them psychically and emotionally in a way that is different from the ordinary. Or they perceive things that normal people discard unconsciously, which results in their perception of a reality that for psychotics is generally painful and many times self-destructive. The psychotic is in a desperate search for freedom, a condition originally due to some great personal unhealed existential crisis. We could say that he or she fell by the wayside. The path that warriors take to freedom can also make them crazy, but they do it without losing themselves. This is what Don Juan meant by controlled folly in a separate reality. And while psychotics are immersed in madness, not of their own choosing, and beyond their ability to control, warriors go about the process of dissolving the ego harmoniously. Their normality disappears at the same time their energy, control, and sobriety are increasing. They know the way of the warrior, and putting all their trust in it, they use it to move about in a world of amazement and mystery, a world of challenges and battles of creation. And from their controlled destiny, warriors are capable of moving about in the most appropriate way with the rest of society, so much so that they are considered most reasonable people. In so-called modern societies, one of the central doings on which is built the ego of the individual, and by extension the ego of the society, is the denial of death. This is prevalent in European and European-based cultures, but it is not in any way universal. Knowledge of death was one of the basic values that governed people's lives on a social as well as individual level in the pre-Columbian cultures of the American continent, particularly the ancient Toltecs. The custom in first world cultures to buy life insurance, to pay for our own burial on credit, to inherit property, and the violent shock produced when we witness another person's death are some examples of just how far we have been trained to consider ourselves immortal. At the bottom, it is the ego who fears death, and rightly so. Faced with it, the ego is reduced to what it really is, nothing. Death is not the negation of life, but rather the negation of the ego. Life, on the other hand, is sustained by death. The life of our bodies is nourished by the deaths of animals and plants, just as our bodies will serve as nourishment for them upon our own death. Thus, inasmuch as the ego and death are antithetical to one another, the awareness of death represents one way to carry us, alive, beyond the boundaries of the ego. While the ego has no way of dealing with death, our body, as a field of energy, has intrinsic knowledge of its true destiny. Our other self can deal directly with the mysterious and interact with the unknown without interference from the non-comprehension of the rational mind. Thus, the awareness of death is a doorway to the awareness of being. We are luminous beings. We are fields of energy, not egos. Awareness of this can only be found outside the world of words. As in recapitulation, we are dealing here with body memory, nearer to feeling than to reason. The not-doings of the personal self are organized into three basic techniques: awareness of death, erasing personal history, and eliminating self-importance, from which can be derived many practical applications. Here are the basic techniques as well as some concrete examples. First, let us look at the idea of death as an advisor. When you feel worn out by life or are about to crumble, remember your death. Take a few moments outside the dynamics of daily events to assess the reality of the situation and to measure it against the fact of your inevitable death. This is especially useful in moments when self-importance is indulging in one of its many variants, gaining control of your person and your moment. You feel self-pity. You feel you are losing something very valuable. You are offended or feel a desire for revenge. You are tied to something that in reality you have already lost. You are mean and deny love. You are fearful. You fear to act according to your deepest wishes. These are the moments in which to take a look into the dark eyes of death and ask its advice. You need the control necessary to look at matters in light of your death, who waits for you, and consider the situation as though it were your last act before dying, until death eliminates all pettiness and fear, until death puts everything in its place, in its proper perspective. Only then can you see that alongside death, the most weighty of everyday problems pales in comparison. Exercises practiced in our work groups that have proven very useful in reaching the awareness of death are those exercises called the awareness of the skeleton. Let us begin with an exercise called touching the skeleton. This exercise is done in pairs. The partners face each other, and with eyes closed, you begin to touch the bone structure of your partner, who remains immobile. Try to sense through touch the shape and sensation of the skull and the rest of the bones. Smoothly and softly, with curiosity, touch the ridges round the eyes, nose, cranium, teeth, roof of mouth, collarbone, scapula, ribs, and so forth. Using tactile sense, try to visualize the skeleton in front of you. As the person touching, imagine yourself as one skeleton touching another. The person receiving concentrates on deepening the awareness of his or her own skeleton. Take approximately 20 minutes for this exercise. A second exercise to consider is called the dance of the skeleton. This exercise is best done with appropriate background music, preferably without words and of a type that invites concentration and sensitivity, music that conveys a feeling of mystery and beauty. Dance in free form, using movement to express your feelings of being alive as skeletons in the world. The magic that allows your skeleton to stand upright represents the brief magic of life. The skeletons dance to this magic and to the shadows among which they move. This will take 10 to 20 minutes. These exercises are to be done in darkness. Practice in an uninhabited area such as a forest, desert, or an open field for best results. The bottom of a canyon or a dry riverbed is excellent. It is easier to do during a full moon. Places near the ocean should be avoided, however. Also, someone should coordinate the exercises, initiate their different phases, start the music, and verbalize helpful phrases for the participants. Naturally, the presence of strangers and interruptions are to be avoided. Now let us turn to exercises relating to erasing personal history. Erasing personal history is perhaps the most general of the not doings of the personal self, since in one way or other, it encompasses all the techniques of not doing. It assumes the termination of the cause-effect relationship between the past and the present. The struggle to erase personal history is a fight against certain internalized elements of our being that can give security by maintaining the ego in a reality that, pleasant or not, is at least familiar, but also against a history that has been internalized by those who are close to us and to whom it gives security as well. There is nothing more menacing to the ego than dealing with a person whom we cannot classify. Don Juan advises Carlos that if he wishes to be free from the ties of what other people think about him, he must begin to erase himself, creating a fog around him that would make him into a mysterious and unpredictable being. This strategy is not only directed toward the outside world. We must erase ourselves to the point where we also become a mystery even to ourselves. The third precept of stalkers is considering themselves also a mystery, along with the other mysteries of the world. Don Juan's first instructions regarding the erasing of personal history can serve as beginning exercises for all people interested in freeing themselves from the confines of their personal history. First, don't automatically reveal everything you do to other people around you, since this impulse comes from the ego's desire to confirm itself, thus fortifying personal history. Second, begin by dealing not only with those people you know well, but also interact with people who have not classified you in agreement with the common past. Third, avoid having to explain and justify everything that you do, and tactfully refuse anyone who demands an explanation. And fourth, don't reveal to anyone what you are up to. It does no good to hide if everyone knows you are hiding. The technique of consciously lying to the self as a form of not doing has proven itself very effective, especially for liberating the self from self-degrading aspects of personal history, those that picture a horrible image. I have recommended it in particular to people who manifest a high level of self-deprecation, thinking that they are the worst people alive. Begin by making an inventory of your thoughts for a period of 8 days. If you are in some kind of crisis of self-degradation, however, 3 days will be sufficient. Opposite your most characteristic negative thoughts, write the compliments. For, I am envious, substitute, it makes me glad to see other people happy. For, I am ugly and unattractive, substitute, I am truly attractive, and so on. During a period of 1 to 3 weeks, depending on the severity of the case, repeat these lies to yourself as often as possible. Think them as though they were the truth. This practice of telling yourself lies not only increases self-confidence, it also tends to reduce mental self-castigation as well. If it is practiced in combination with a general strategy of stalking, the tendency to indulge in self-deprecation can disappear altogether. This is not, as some might think, a kind of brainwashing or self-suggestion. The practitioner does not believe the lies are true. Rather, the exercise engages the attention in a doing that is different from the ordinary. When the practitioner is capable of perceiving both as being unreal, they can be dispensed with altogether. An exercise called disrupting the routines of life is a basic technique used in erasing personal history. I have singled it out here because of its importance and broad scope, as well as to stress the relative ease with which it can be applied to everyday life. It constitutes one of the fastest ways to dissolve the ego, and eventually to stop the world. Sometimes breaking routines is very difficult, since they are all that we have as ordinary people to give meaning to our lives. It is quite enough to think of routines such as boredom, anger, self-pity, smoking, overeating, or arriving late, to realize the enormous difficulty involved in attempting to break them. But it is not impossible if we have a strategy. The principal strategy of a stalker is that you stalk yourself, your habits. You do this by quietly observing their manifestation. Thus you see how habits, or doings, are made up of component parts. And doing, like any automatic mechanism, needs all of its parts in order to function. So if you want to stop a habit, instead of trying to force yourself to stop, merely remove one of its components, and the habit cannot then be reproduced. An example might be smoking. The list of components would include cigarettes, matches, time, lack of exercise, lack of deep breaths, lack of relaxation, and stress. Then in place of forcing ourselves to quit smoking, We simply develop the habit of climbing mountains, say, and the smoking will disappear by itself. There is no need to eliminate all the elements of a particular doing. Simply by removing a single element, it will not be reproduced. Through stalking, any routine can be disarmed by the elimination of only one of its essential elements. Another important group of exercises relates to eliminating self-importance. Eliminating self-importance is the prime task of a warrior, since it consumes the greater part of his or her energy. Don Juan put it this way, "In the strategic inventories of warriors, self-importance figures as the activity that consumes the greatest amount of energy, hence their effort to eradicate it. One of the first concerns of a warrior is to free that energy in order to face the unknown with it. The action of rechanneling that energy is impeccability." Don Juan suggested to Carlos that in order to stop taking himself so seriously, he should begin by talking aloud to plants, an idea the apprentice found ridiculous. This simple technique is of great usefulness, especially in moments when you are angry or affected by some other attack of self-importance. Choose any small plant that happens to be nearby, asking if it please would help, because self-importance is such an enormous weight to carry around. This must be done aloud. Another technique for overcoming self-importance is acting for the sake of acting. Any absurd activity can serve for this technique. The important thing is to do it scrupulously, with complete attention. As ordinary people, full of self-importance, we expect results from all our actions, some type of payment. But if we want to be warriors, then we need to learn to act for the sake of acting. One way to learn to act for the sake of acting is to establish absurd routines that should be discarded once they have become habits themselves. Here are some examples. Pile the rocks in your garden into separate groups according to size and shape, or take the kitchen dishes for a ride in the car once a week. A variation would be to take on tasks that require a high degree of effort and concentration, but again without thought of reward. For example, move an enormous rock for 1 mile and then return it to where you found it. Or carve a statue from wood as carefully as you can, and when finished, throw it on a bonfire or in a river. Another useful technique for lessening self-importance is dedicating ourselves for a specific time to taking care of someone, body and soul, especially if the person is not to our liking. For the ego, normally accustomed to taking care of its own needs, this technique can be devastating. Generally, it is best done in secret without telling the person what we are up to, unless we are dealing with a sick person or some other situation requiring the approval of the person to be cared for. To achieve the capacity to care with true devotion and disinterest, choose a person whose care would not benefit you in the slightest degree from your ego's point of view. Playing the fool is a technique especially for those who like to make an impression on others, for all those who have a compulsive desire to make spectators of everyone around them. These people secretly like to call attention to themselves, appearing always as the most clever, the most agile, the best athlete, the best friend, the most handsome, the most beautiful, the best lover, the one who never loses an argument. In short, those who do everything well. One simple way of combating this compulsion is by striving to deliberately create the opposite effect. Without anyone knowing, intentionally play the part of the fool. If you are someone who is very careful and agile in your movements, begin to act clumsy, tripping over or dropping things, for example. In an argument, make ridiculous statements that make you look like an idiot, thus losing the argument. If you are identified with the woodroom look, dress shabbily in order to appear ludicrous in places where you are accustomed to showing off. And certainly, as Florinda Donner stated in The Eagle's Gift, all those who learn to play the role of the fool without feeling hurt are capable of fooling anyone. Now we will move on to the matter of stopping the internal dialogue. The possibility of silencing thoughts is most frequently encountered in the many forms of knowledge with which the West is only marginally familiar. In conditions of everyday life, we find ourselves thinking. I do not refer here to what could be considered the systematic exercising of true reason, but rather the simple act of uncontrolled thinking that we do all the time. We are always talking to ourselves in our thoughts. This is what Don Juan termed the internal dialogue, and its suspension forms one of the central points of his teaching. Since we are always talking to ourselves, we consider it a natural and inevitable condition of human life. We unconsciously assume that this dialogue will be shut off only after death, and that the possibility of a totally blank mind cannot exist. This belief is further reinforced by the fact that many who do try to shut their minds off often fail in the attempt. When Western thought attempts to criticize itself, it looks timidly toward Oriental thought, visualizing a world divided in an Oriental-Occidental dichotomy. This leaves out of the scene many peoples who developed along different lines, and whose view of the cosmos lies outside that of either Eastern or Western ways of thinking. This includes all the American Indian peoples who, from Alaska to Tierra del Fuego, created their own great civilizations in the past. Their philosophical and magical scientific knowledge remains yet undetected by anthropologists and ethnologists of our time. The technical superiority and conquistadors' weaponry by which they were able to overpower the Indians caused them to discard beforehand all possibility of learning from these Indian cultures. They could not conceive of the existence of technical or spiritual development on the part of pre-Columbian peoples, vanquished in the 16th century, and remaining today on the lowest rung of the evolutionary ladder, according to the logic that puts European civilizations at the top. So little is known of ways to achieve and the results of a state of no mind, according to Oriental mentality and practice, and even less is known about said state in the experience of the American Indian. In reality, the state of suspended thought exists as a possibility for any human being, regardless of when and where it is encountered. This knowledge recurs anywhere there is a genuine interest in self-knowledge. In Western mentality, we are trained to think that the attainment of an objective supposes, in the first place, that we understand and know what such an objective consists of, and in the second place, that attaining such an objective is worth the trouble, creating in us the desire to achieve it. Of course, desiring it implies thinking about it, thinking that we desire it, that we want to achieve it. The uselessness of such mental activity results from making thinking the objective of desire, and therefore of thought as well. This path is a mental labyrinth from which there is no escape. Oriental teachings insist on the value of eliminating desire. Westerners might think that such an achievement would make them into apathetic and passive persons, incapable of doing or enjoying anything. Quite to the contrary, however, what Oriental teachings realize is the intrinsic relation between desire and thought. One serves as the motive force for the other. It is not possible to stop thinking by thinking about it. Western rationality simply does not work as a method for achieving inner silence. The first thing to stress is that thinking is not perceiving. Thinking is not perceiving. As human beings, we can think and we can perceive. The problem is, even though our intimate natures as fields of energy mean we are natural perceivers, we are so tied to our thoughts that we do not perceive our possibilities as such. This is not by accident. Thought is what makes up the basic nature of the ego. In fact, thoughts are the substance of the ego. Therefore, stopping the internal dialogue allows us to leave the confines of the ego, freeing ourselves from the personal history that it sustains and that, in its turn, sustains the ego itself. If we do not perceive people, things, or the situations in which we find ourselves, but instead see or believe what our thoughts dictate to us, which we continually project toward the exterior world, then it must be true that the suspension of thought represents the open door to perception. Our concepts about life, love, a mate, success, progress, and all of the values that we regard as being the ideal are thus revealed as a mental fog. We give reality to these ideas and thoughts because of our insistence on behaving in agreement with the description that was taught to us. Only we discover later that it is difficult to make our lives fit into this description. In any event, it is much too impoverished and boring for all that we are able to do in our one life as mortal, and therefore magical beings. A person who perceives, on the other hand, can act in accordance with true reality, and thus enjoys a tremendous advantage over other human beings. This possibility, available to anyone, to lift the veil of thought and see the real world, represents power and freedom. Up until now, we have spoken of the pertinence of stopping the internal dialogue as a way of managing ordinary reality more efficiently, a fact that can be inferred from the recovery of perception implied. But the perception of ordinary reality that lies beyond the veil of thought is just the first step toward realizing the unknown possibilities of awareness. In Don Juan's system of knowledge, inner silence serves as a starting point from which we can penetrate into the separate reality. Don Juan refers to stopping the internal dialogue as the key to the door between the worlds. When the internal word factory shuts down, the world and our own person also cease to be, and to appear exactly as we told ourselves they were. Then other facets of reality, formerly considered strange or impossible, become accessible, and this represents yet another face of true freedom. This refers to our magical heritage, to the possibility of leaving a world not of our own choosing, in which our limits are set by the tonal of the times and by personal history, and entering a world that formerly existed only in our dreams. It's true that this separate reality seems to be fantastic, if not impossible, to the average man or woman, talking to a tree, exchanging words with a whale, becoming aware of the earth as a sentient being, acting deliberately with a dreaming body. It is also true that in this other reality, the confines of our way of being, acting, and feeling, determined by personal history, vanish, giving opportunities to reinvent ourselves, to discover mysterious and unknown facets of ourselves lying hidden in remote corners of our being. Once recovered, these can be integrated into a new way of living and acting in the world of everyday affairs, with new resources formerly considered out of reach. Thus, to enter into the other reality does not necessarily imply strange things, such as carrying out vital objectives in the realm of dreams. There are also such unusual things as sincerely looking upon our fellows without hate, loving without slavery, discovering a new being in the mirror, daring to make a long-held dream a reality, looking at a loved one with new eyes, saying goodbye to a long-held habit we had thought to be an intrinsic part of ourselves. We will now explore some ways these might be achieved. One of the fundamental elements for stopping the internal dialogue is the specialized use of attention, meaning ordinary attention, which by saving energy allows the recovery of what Don Juan labeled the second attention. Since the ordinary way in which we use our attention is intimately linked to sustaining the internal dialogue, then using that attention in a non-ordinary way is necessary for the suspension of the internal dialogue. One factor that feeds the internal dialogue is that our attention is constantly focused on it. The voice of the internal dialogue is the voice of the ego. So what is occurring here is the obsessive tendency for the ego to focus on itself. Any practice or exercise that diverts the attention from this internal word factory tends to suspend dialogue activities if the effort is sustained long enough. That is, if no attention is paid to it, the dialogue stops. Thus, almost all of the exercises for stopping the internal dialogue use redirection of the attention as their key element. Using this information as a starting point, you could make up your own exercises. Nevertheless, we will mention some that have yielded fruitful results. The first is the walk of attention. Walking by itself is good exercise that contributes to good health, as we all know. But what is not generally known is that by adding certain special elements, we can convert a simple walk into a walk of attention. The unquestionable masters of walking are the Indians, who for centuries have walked tirelessly over the surface of the earth, over the paths of the being they love. From them, we can learn many of the elements of walking correctly. The walk of attention is an excellent exercise for stopping the internal dialogue. Frequent practice will unfailingly produce a state of silence. Before going into detail about its many variations, here are some of its basic elements. First, your attention is focused not on thoughts, but rather on the walk itself and the elements of attention. Second, walk in absolute silence. Should it be absolutely necessary to talk, stop walking for a moment and say what needs to be said before continuing. Third, don't try to forcibly stop your thoughts. Simply let them flow, listening to them as though they were just any other natural sound. Fourth, focus attention on sounds. One of the most surprising results of the walk of attention is that altered states of consciousness are generated. More commonly known as heightened awareness, they can have different levels. The more attentive and prolonged the walk, the more profound will be the effect of heightened awareness. Also, frequency of practice has a direct bearing on the results obtained. Walking Indian file is like the preceding exercise, except it is practiced by several persons. The walk has particular implications among indigenous peoples, and there are basic differences between them and the way a Westerner walks. The Western attitude tends to view any trip as consisting of two main points, departure and arrival. Thus, on any trip, be it walking or in some vehicle, what lies along the way is of little importance. The main objective is to arrive. The sooner, the better. Walking only serves as a means for arriving, and therefore our prevailing attitude along the way is one of impatience, of being anxious to arrive. Or, on the contrary, we feel distress for what we left behind. The fact is that modern Westerners have a serious problem locating themselves where in reality they are, here and now. Thus, walking Western style, used simply as a means for getting them from one place to another, is tiring, and we wish for it to end as soon as possible. Naturally, this produces much fatigue, a fatigue that arises mostly from wasted energy, not from the energy required for walking. Indigenous peoples, on the other hand, after centuries of walking, know that walking is the means by which one can experience being in the here and now, besides serving as a way of getting somewhere. They know that it is possible and beneficial to walk for the sake of walking, for the pure pleasure of movement. Another approach to the walk of attention is the walk of shadows. Although this exercise is quite simple, it can provoke intense states of heightened awareness. This walk is also known as walking with the ears. It consists of a very slow walk of attention, trying to move about like a shadow, in absolute silence, reducing the sounds you produce while walking to almost zero. Neither steps nor breathing should be audible. You should not even be able to hear yourself, but be as silent as a shadow moving about. What guides movement is the work of your ears. You concentrate so much on sounds, in order to avoid them, that hearing becomes the center of your perception. Needless to say that in this form of walking, you avoid stepping on anything that is likely to produce sound. It is preferable to lift your foot before running into a branch, to go around things instead of stepping on them, to always look to step where it will make the least noise. Yet another form of the walk of attention is called the gait of power. In general terms, the gait of power consists of moving at great speed, utilizing an unusual energy, without depending on the five senses in the ordinary way, and without acquiring prior knowledge of the terrain, even in complete darkness. It resembles a peculiar form of running or jogging. Although it can be practiced over any kind of terrain, it is usually done where the surface is uneven, with many loose rocks, on a steep slope, or when we find ourselves at night in similar areas that would be difficult to cross under normal conditions, even walking. The gait of power is something that belongs to the body's unknown possibilities. In reality, all of us know how to do it, or it would be more precise to say our bodies know how. Average people, however, find themselves so disconnected from what the body knows, having lived exclusively according to the whims of the ego via the internal dialogue, that they find it almost impossible to recover this knowledge. Occasionally, people in life or death situations, or some other dangerous predicament, have been known to enter into the gate of power and save themselves by running in complete darkness, or over rugged terrain near drop-offs, without realizing it and without the use of any procedure. When phenomena of this nature occur, they are often considered miracles or some kind of divine intervention by people looking for some way to explain the marvels that can occur when the body takes the reins. Begin by trotting on flat ground in daylight, raising your knees as high as possible. From this moment, the body takes charge. Reason and ego are not allowed to participate. You enter into a peculiar state that could be labeled relaxed tension, but with an internal feeling of sobriety and control. As you begin to feel comfortable, start practicing under more rigorous conditions, such as level but irregular terrain, terrain with rocks, or a dry riverbed. Gradually increase your velocity. Notice how the flexibility in your legs allows them to adjust naturally over rocks, fallen tree trunks, or other obstacles. Little by little, try to sense the terrain with your body, avoiding excessive use of your eyes to guide your feet. As your ability increases, look for steep slopes with irregular terrain. If you begin by practicing on paths, you will have more control across open country, but it is very important not to overdo it. Nothing can be achieved through great velocity if you lose rhythm and security. Begin to deliberately change velocity according to the variations of the terrain, maintaining the same rhythm. When you have attained a high degree of facility, try practicing at sunset or under a full moon over known terrain. As you gain proficiency, attempt to do it on a totally dark night. When you reach this level, you no longer find yourself, as an ego, voluntarily carrying out the exercise. Your body acts according to a direct relation it has with the world, beyond the boundaries of reason. Since the internal dialogue and the gate of power are events that cannot take place simultaneously, we should have begun to notice, almost from the start, that the dialogue tends to stop without any direct intervention on our part. As the gate of power demands the participation of all our energy, there is none left over to keep the internal dialogue going. This is what makes the technique infallible. If we keep on thinking, however, it means we are merely engaged in jogging, not in the gate of power. Doing the gate of power, especially in uninhabited areas at night, it is not uncommon to feel as though we become transformed into some type of animal. It can be felt by the change in breathing, in the security with which we move, and in the sounds we involuntarily emit. Now let us turn to the subject of the special use of the senses. Since the internal dialogue functions hand in hand with the ordinary way in which we use our five senses, then a modification in the way we use our senses can help us to achieve silence. In the consumerism of modern society, the sense of sight could well be called the king of the senses. The whole system of consumerism depends on visual impact as the key element. Therefore, for ordinary people, the other senses take second place. So under the spell of sight are we, that we hardly pay attention to what our other senses could reveal to us. And this occurs because the sense of sight has become the docile servant of the internal dialogue. What we see and the way in which we see it is maintained by the internal dialogue in such a way that reality is not meaningful to us from the outside. Since we have trained the sense of sight to aid us in this process, if we force it to perceive in a different way, or if we change the normal hierarchy in the use of our senses, we can stop our internal dialogue. An example of this, already mentioned, would be the walk of shadows in which hearing and touch capture the attention that normally we give only to sight. Any unusual use of the senses can serve as an exercise for achieving inner silence. For example, try the following exercise. Remain in complete silence with your eyes closed for periods of at least 15 minutes, listening to the sounds entering your ears. The majority of special breathing techniques are also useful in silencing the mind, since they direct our attention to breathing rather than thoughts. Focusing attention on breathing is, in fact, one of the basic general forms for achieving silence. This is why many meditation techniques can be appropriate, especially if we avoid associating them with religion, esotericism, symbolism, or other isms. Depending on the degree to which its practice is connected with feelings rather than thoughts, any sincere artistic activity can bring us near to silence, especially any that does not require the use of language. Particularly useful are the art of dance and the playing of a musical instrument, since their practice involves a high degree of concentration. Much the same phenomenon occurs in the world of sports. Natural sport done for pleasure and challenge is highly beneficial for our body, but not for the ego, not only for health reasons. Since it requires reactions and reflexes faster than we can think, it gives an opportunity to act for reasonably long periods without the intervention of the internal dialogue. It has the additional advantage of putting us in contact with our corporeal being, letting us rest temporarily from the tyranny of the ego. Especially beneficial are those sports that involve integral and respectful contact with nature, taking care, of course, not to damage her, which is also a way of avoiding damage to ourselves. As has been mentioned, attention is one of the key words found throughout the works of Carlos Castaneda. The specific way in which we use our attention causes us to perceive reality in the way we do. In that sense, attention sustains the world. Attention is that property of awareness that causes us to focus on certain aspects of internal or external reality while discarding others. But in the Don Juanist vision of reality, as in modern physics, there is much more to the world than what is perceived normally. In fact, it contains an infinite number of elements that escape our perception. For modern physicists and chemists, technology has served as a way of perceiving and manipulating certain aspects of this invisible reality, such as radio waves, radiation, or television signals. The sorcerer, on the other hand, since time immemorial, has used another tool for witnessing and manipulating this separate reality, the magic of attention. A small child functions with a perception much less restricted than that of an adult. Therefore, oftentimes the child will perceive aspects of reality that adults can no longer see, that they would discard as childish fantasies. Non-orthodox modern psychology has given credit to observed phenomena in the peculiar world of infantile perception. An example can be found in the dermal optical phenomenon, visual perception through the skin, in which any child with the proper training is capable of seeing and reading with the hands or feet. In the world of Don Juan, the sorcerers and apprentices are warriors struggling to rescue this possibility of using their perception in new ways, much like what we knew as infants, to aid them in penetrating into other worlds. Following are exercises that could properly be classified as exercises of attention, as well as some in which the work of Castaneda is classified simply as not doings. These are included together here, since both groups tend to produce substantial variations in perception through intentionally modifying the use of attention. The first exercise is called observing shadows. Find a large leafy bush. Find a comfortable, relaxed position in which you can concentrate on the bush. Calmly observe a branch, but instead of focusing on the leaves, concentrate your attention exclusively on their shadows until you find yourself looking at a branch of shadows in place of leaves. Widen your field of view, concentrating only on the shadows. Try to perceive the entire bush as a bush of shadows. A second exercise of attention is walking backward. This simple technique can be practiced over almost any kind of terrain, depending on the ability of the participant. The exercise entails walking backward without turning around to see where you are going. In the beginning, practice on flat level ground without dangerous irregularities, only gradually increasing the degree of difficulty as you continue the practice. One principal aspect of this technique is that it can teach us to perceive the exterior world without depending so much on our eyes. We are not trying to visualize what lies behind us, as that would keep us dependent on our eyes. Rather, we are looking for a feeling of security emanating from corporeal consciousness using non-visual stimuli. The reality is that the entire body is capable of functioning as a perceiver, not just the eyes alone. The correct attitude is one of patience, relaxation, and if possible, inner silence. A third exercise of attention is called the purifying harness. In The Eagle's Gift, Castaneda mentions using a harness to suspend the self above the ground as a not-doing that has the virtue of purifying the body and even curing illnesses that are not physical. He also says that its beneficial effect can be used to prepare the self for a difficult journey or any other experience requiring maximum effort, and he presents it in two variations, suspending from the ceiling or suspending from the branch of a tree. This exercise is best done at night. For both variations, the first step is to gather the necessary harness, one in which you can remain suspended for long periods without pain or discomfort. Those used in parachuting, speleology, or something similar would work. To perform the tree variation, find a large tree with strong, thick limbs. Ask the tree's permission, speaking aloud, to work in it, and ask for its help, explaining your motives for doing so. Although it might never occur to us, it could happen that the tree would be opposed to sending any kind of sensitive message. If this is the case, you will have to look for another tree. When you have found the right tree, climb up the selected branch and prepare it for the passing of the main rope. The preparation consists of wrapping the branch with canvas or some other type of resistant cloth, tying it securely. This is to protect the branch from injury from the main rope. Once the supports are in place, pass the free end of the rope over the limb, enter the harness, and be pulled up. Be very attentive to any manifestation on the part of the tree, which will react to your presence. Remember that you are inside its luminous cocoon. Communicate with the tree, express your feelings, or sing to it. This exercise is best done in an isolated area, away from people not involved in your work. Three elements to keep in mind while doing this exercise are absolute silence, darkness, and maintaining a high level of concentration during the preparatory stages. The longer and higher a person remains suspended, the greater will be the effect. It is possible to find trees with suitable branches at heights of 30 feet or more. It may be practiced for several days in a row, or the participant can remain suspended day and night. In this case, begin at dawn and end at dawn of the following day. All the exercises of attention and not doing should be carried out with tranquility and without haste, since their effect is cumulative. Average people, accustomed only to doing, can easily become bored or fatigued with exercises of not doing, especially if there are no quick or spectacular results. Persistence and effort are the basic factors. The effect of being immersed for hours in not doing is manifest even in those cases where it is felt that nothing happened. Concentration is important, and it is something that the apprentice must learn. We are accustomed to letting our attention and our thoughts wander and digress without any control on our part. Little by little, we can learn to direct our first attention and to concentrate. Only then will we come finally to inner silence and forms of attention that we did not realize existed. Let us turn now to the subject of dreams. Western mentality tends to think of dreams as an illusory reality, or as not reality at all. This is just one more consequence of the modern tendency to conclude that anything that does not fit the ordinary description of reality does not exist. Therefore, dream experiences such as flying, conversion into strange beings, or talking to animals must necessarily be discounted as being unreal. The most that science has been able to do in giving meaning to dreams has been in the realm of psychoanalytic theory, with roots in the work of Sigmund Freud in the late 19th and early 20th centuries. In its most basic form, the theory states that dreams are more or less symbolic expressions of a person's repressed desires, fears, and anxieties. Although most people remain ignorant of Freudian theory and its possibilities for interpreting the meaning of dreams, its basic proposition is applicable in general terms to the majority of people in modern society. Our dreams do indeed reflect our fears and desires. However, Freud is not the only possibility. An examination of other cultures, both past and present, reveals that the conclusions of this theory, like psychoanalytical theory in general, are not universal. It is easily demonstrated that not all human beings have the same type of dreams, that not all dreams are Freudian. The author's personal experience among the Huichol Indians, for example, has permitted him to observe the special interest they have in their dreams. It is very common to find a father asking his small son, who has barely learned to talk, "What did you dream, my son?" Remember well, what did you dream? In this way, the Huichols begin very early to pay attention to their dreams, an ability that not only facilitates remembering, but also gives their dreams a pragmatic significance. Significance completely outside any Freudian interpretations. Their dreams are messages, omens, indications, promises. For them, dreams are just as real as planting crops, constructing houses, having children, writing songs, or anything else in their lives. Dreams influence their decision-making and their way of life. So, if it is true that in our society we only know Freudian dreams, it is also true that they are not our only possibility. There exist other ways to dream, ways that open the door to unusual experiences, ways that lead to the second attention, power, and awareness of the other self. We can learn these other ways. We can learn to set up dreaming. As related to us by Castaneda, one of the two great areas of practice, the other is stalking, among the warriors of the Nagual's party, involves working in the realm of dreams. Setting up dreaming begins with what seems like a very simple technique. We must dream we are looking at our hands. So simple. Before going to sleep, we give ourselves the order to find our hands in our dreams. It is, however, not as simple as it appears when we experience it firsthand and confront it in all its magnitude. Anyone who has achieved this knows what we are talking about. When we find our hands in dreams, the sensation it gives us is very strange and intense. It feels as strange as we would feel if, in this exact moment, the room we are in were to disappear in front of our very eyes, to be replaced by some kind of phantom reality. Naturally, an event like this would cause a high degree of amazement. We would feel excitement at having discovered another world whose existence we had never suspected. And amazement is precisely what is felt upon finding our hands in our dreams, nothing less. When our dreaming bodies, what Castaneda refers to as the dreamed, look at their hands, they are obeying an order that comes from another world, from a world that they did not know existed. The everyday world is the other world for the dreamed, and the dreamed, as one of the aspects of the awareness of the other self, does not remember or know anything of the dreamer or that world. The dreamed knows nothing of the tonal, the counterpart, as the Nagual, is the counterpart of the dreamer. For the dreamed, everyday reality is as inconceivable and unreal as the dreamed world is for us. The fact is that the dreamed and the dreamer never remember one another. They live in parallel realities, together but separated. We are the other selves for the dreamed, and our world is their separate reality. Ultimately, our rationality makes the world of the dreamed a mere fantasy extension of the reality that we know. A world of illusion that has no real existence, or we simply forget what we've dreamed. To truly remember the other would imply that we are indeed the dream of the dreaming body. And this is precisely what the dreaming bodies do when they look at their hands. They become aware they are dreaming, and they remember the dreamer and the dreamer's world. And with this simple act, they perform an unusual maneuver. They create a point of contact between the two sides of awareness, between worlds that normally never touch, that mutually ignore each other. The ultimate purpose behind all the work with stalking and dreaming is to remember the other self in order to integrate that self into that totality. For Don Juan, dreaming is the best avenue to power because it is the door that leads directly to the Nagual, returning us to the unknown and mysterious side of our awareness. One of the aspects that makes dreaming an area of such usefulness is the reciprocal relationship it has with the world of everyday life. What is incredible is how this reciprocity functions. The modification of the way we approach everyday life modifies the way we dream, and the modification of the way we dream can modify our everyday life. The realm of our dreams also becomes an area in which we can work for change and for freedom. This means that we can change aspects of our daily life during dreams. Aspects impossible to change using conventional methods can be modified with the help of the other self, and with the power of the second attention that belongs to that self, simply by focusing our dreaming on them. Castaneda tells us that the warriors of his group developed and enriched the basic activities of their daily lives through dreaming. Pablito, as a carpenter, learned how to build things. Nestor, who sold medicinal plants, found ways of curing the sick. And Benigno, who had an oracle, found solutions for people's problems. Thus, persons with tasks that they consider to be truly their own will find in dreaming fertile soil for the harvesting of secrets that will enrich them. Finding lost objects or missing persons, curing illnesses, or deciding on a course of action are a few examples of what can be achieved through the not doing of normal dreaming, to say nothing of the fun and marvel of witnessing incredible worlds through the vehicle of the dreaming body. In dreaming, it is possible to focus on things of this world as well as of the other. Not doing while dreaming entails learning to perceive as we do naturally in our everyday world. While the problem in daily life is learning to transform a reality we generally regard as fixed and immutable, in dreaming there is presented the opposite problem of sustaining a reality that normally is constantly changing. A special form of attention is required to maintain in focus the contents of a dream and thus achieve a functional order amongst the chaos so characteristic of ordinary dreams. By this I mean we cannot stare fixedly at a dream image without it transforming into something else. Rather than a group of techniques for achieving dreaming, Castaneda's work puts forth a series of tasks to perform once dreaming awareness has been attained, although there are no specific steps for arriving at said awareness. This is natural since this awareness has to do with an unaccustomed movement of the assemblage point. Any specific instructions may or may not be appropriate depending on our specific situation, our particular doings. First, we will present the different steps we must carry out in order to consolidate awareness of the dreaming body. Later, we will go into detail on the techniques, which in reality are aids to bring our awareness to remember the other self during dreaming. There really is no way to say how to do it. What happens is that in a given moment, our body simply does it. It remembers. Everything begins with remembering the other self. At a given moment, you as the dreamed simply remember to carry out some task, such as looking at your hands. The specific item chosen is not important. What matters is to give yourself the order while awake and carry it out while dreaming. As the dreamed remembers, you perceive the order coming from somewhere, and then you remember the other world. You remember the dreamer. From this point, dreaming begins, and all the tasks you must complete can now be carried out. In spite of its seeming simplicity, The first step is usually the most difficult. If you insist on maintaining the fixed and mechanically repetitive practice of doing in everyday life, it will be practically impossible to develop the necessary freedom to practice dreaming. The reverse is also true. Practicing the not doing of dreaming prepares you for not doing in ordinary life. Therefore, what is needed is coordinated effort on the part of both the dreamer and the dreamed in the practice of not doing. If you want to find your hands in your dreams, besides giving yourself the order to do so, you must also saturate your body with not doing during the day. The general procedure would consist of spending the whole day in activities that are totally out of the ordinary. Particularly effective results are obtained if these activities are in no way flattering to the ego. Treating the ego in an unflattering way tends to shrink the tonal and therefore is very useful in setting up dreaming. Any of the exercises of attention, not doing, or stopping the internal dialogue are appropriate for setting up dreaming. Once you find your hands for the first time, it gradually becomes easier. Each time you practice the not doing of dreams, your body is filling itself with the cumulative effect of not doing, which serves as raw material for further dreaming experiences. We have already stated briefly that the base upon which dreaming is developed is the capacity to sustain dream images. This is the first task we must carry out once we have remembered the other self and have looked at our hands. Fortunately, there is a procedure to make things easier. The dreamer need only shift his or her gaze to other objects in the dreaming scene when the first one begins to fade or change. So, from your hands, you look next at any other object. When it begins to change, return to your hands, then back to the object, and so on. Little by little, begin to take in more objects until you are able to sustain the entire dream image. The next step, after learning how to sustain the dream images, is to learn how to move. Moving and dreaming requires a period of training. It has nothing to do with movement, such as is experienced in ordinary dreams, which is done mechanically, without any intention on your part. Again, that word of subtle and mysterious context, the will, comes into play. In dreaming, you use your will to move. The next phase relates to controlling the coordinates, space and time, of your trip, where the dream takes place and in what specific moment. To begin, choose the place you wish to go while dreaming. This can be accomplished in two ways: either begin your dreaming in the chosen place, or, starting from a dreaming state, then move to where you wish to be. The first is recommended over the second, since the second takes more time and requires a high degree of control of movement, as well as a good sense of location. When you can make the time and space of dreaming coincide with that of everyday affairs, you are ready to begin to influence your daily life using your dreaming body. Finally, we come to the true test of fire that tells you, the dreamer, if you are truly dreaming, a face-to-face encounter between the dreamer and the dreamed. When you are capable of controlling the time and place of your dreaming, you can verify directly whether your dreaming is taking place during the same time as your everyday world. Have an encounter with your physical body asleep in bed. The task now consists of looking for yourself. You, the dreamed, know that someone is dreaming you, and now you have to have the fortitude and control to find out who is doing the dreaming. If you find the dreamer, instead of being frightened or waking up, the dreamer knows the moment of power has arrived and instead makes use of the experience to achieve the impossible, to influence your everyday world using your dreaming body. From the moment the dreamer encounters his or her physical body asleep, he or she can then begin to make a more pragmatic use of dreaming. From the outset, it must be stressed that at no time is the physical body to be awakened. Castaneda indicates that to do so would mean death. In any case, there is no need to experiment. There are more useful things to do. We can relive problematic scenes from daily life, discover how the dreaming body would resolve them, and later apply these solutions to everyday life. We can develop creative abilities in any personal activities we are involved in, painting, writing, healing, singing, dancing, constructing, and so forth. Creativity knows no limits in the world of the Nagual. Forgiving, letting go of resentment, and approaching other human beings are also things that can be done with dreaming, providing we have the control to locate the person in question in our dreaming. Naturally, approaching anyone this way should be done in a sober and disinterested manner, Any desire to use this power to damage or abuse another would be highly self-destructive. It would not agree with the way of the warrior who, unlike black magicians, can never look upon fellow human beings with intent of harming them, using them, or obtaining personal gratification. Next, let us turn to the matter of corporal perception. The first truth of the mastery of awareness, according to Castaneda, is that human beings are part of and suspended within the eagle's emanations. This truth in particular alludes to the fact that we are luminous beings, specific presences located in a universe made up of fields of energy. The portion of energy that we are is contained during our lives in a form or mold known as the human form. The essential characteristic of that field of energy is the ability to perceive. In speaking of our natural ability as perceivers, we are not referring to the ego, which is a verbalizer, not a perceiver, but rather to the body as a field of energy. Therefore, there is no point in trying to determine which parts of the body perceive. The entire luminous cocoon perceives. Corporal perception takes place with the totality of the body, even the part that lies beyond the boundaries of the skin. According to Sears, perceiving this way makes us look like large luminous eggs. Don Juan proposes that we can use our senses in ways outside the ordinary, that we can comprehend the nature of things without having to think about it, that the body has within itself silent knowledge and its own memory. Corporal perception, as referred to in the works of Don Carlos, is a silent knowledge that has nothing to do with words or thoughts. Rather, it implies a direct interaction between the body and the world. Thus, the purpose of the following section is to present some techniques that put an emphasis on the relation between the body and the world, especially the world of nature where there is no place for rational thinking. We will begin with an exercise called the Walk of the Midpoint. The first thing required is to locate with mathematical precision the exact midpoint of the body. Measure it right to the millimeter to find the exact midpoint in both length and width. Once found, it can be marked with ink or by placing a small pebble on the spot, taping it in place or using a type of glue that will not damage the skin. Locating this point is useful not only for this technique, but for many others as well, since centering attention on it will permit a more heightened perception in any situation. With the midpoint located and marked, begin the walk. Generally speaking, it consists of the same elements as those indicated for the walk of attention, only in this case your attention will be centered on three principal aspects: the midpoint, the breathing, and the surroundings. Breathing plays the role of helping to achieve rhythm and concentration while walking. Attention on the surroundings is intuitive, not visual. Your eyes should sweep the ground directly in front of your feet, thus it would be helpful to have some kind of guidance, such as doing it in a group Indian file, or if alone over known terrain. The key to this exercise is to locate perception and awareness in your midpoint, sensing that place as though it were the root of your perception. Take long walks to practice perceiving a variety of different surroundings, feeling the distinct nature of each place without the use of your eyes. This does not imply trying to imagine visually what the surroundings look like. Rather, it involves directly sensing how each place affects your energy and feelings. The pebble taped to your midpoint, by the way, can also be used as an aid in setting up dreaming. Simply sleep with it in place. Previously, we referred superficially to the practice of using a blindfold. A more detailed version is one of the exercises most representative of corporal perception. This one and those that follow fall into the category of what we have called exercises of the blind. In these exercises, we are the blind persons. Instead of reducing our activities in fear of not being able to see, we increase them. This makes possible the emergence of a form of attention that will permit us to experience our other four senses in an especially intense and unaccustomed way. Even more important, it allows the body to remember little by little. The body can function as a perceiver in ways that will not necessarily agree with what we consider to be the ordinary way to perceive through the senses. The trick is to be ready to forget the world the way we are accustomed to perceiving it with our eyes. Most people, while temporarily blindfolded, try to visualize their surroundings through imagination and memory. Here it is best to forget our eyes and what they have told us about the world in order to penetrate into a world without light. This means discovering that fear and archaic rejection of darkness are but prejudice that we can do away with. As in the natural world of day and night, light and shadow, in our own being we find corresponding ontological variability. Thus, if we accept darkness as a natural condition, we give ourselves the possibility of adjusting to it, of coming into contact with our being of darkness that has nothing to do with the usual absurd association between darkness and evil. The first exercise we will consider is called the Home of the Blind. This exercise consists of remaining at home, blindfolded all day, carrying out all of the ordinary activities that can be done without putting yourself in danger. Sweeping the floor, getting dressed, drawing, writing, listening to music, doing exercise. Cooking can be done as long as extreme caution is taken with the stove, especially a gas stove. At the end of the day, go to bed, leaving the blindfold on until dawn of the following day. The presence of someone to assist is recommended. Next, let us try an exercise called the Race to the Unknown. This allows us to penetrate in a more direct and profound way into the experience of corporal perception. It requires the presence of at least two assistants with the necessary strength and ability to serve as effective aids during its execution. The Race to the Unknown consists of running at top speed between two previously chosen points while blindfolded. It should be done over flat ground, either bare or grass-covered earth. Obstacles that could trip the runner should be avoided, even small ones such as rocks, bushes, or any protuberance in the soil within the area marked off for the exercise, as well as in the area immediately surrounding it. The success of these exercises depends on creating conditions that instill confidence for their physical safety in those participating. Initially, the exercise by itself tends to provoke fear and insecurity, and participants will tend to run cautiously. But if those participating have sufficient confidence in those who are coordinating the exercise, trusting that all details have been taken care of and that there is no real danger, they are much more likely to let go, knowing the only obstacle is their own internal fear. Making sure the runner is well taken care of in the first attempts will inspire his or her confidence. A frequent comment about this exercise is that it can produce what has been called the tunnel effect. This refers to the effect produced when you have conquered all fear and have fully accepted the darkness. In that moment, the sensation of darkness is experienced like a black tunnel through which you pass with dizzying speed. As though it were riding a toboggan, the body feels pulled onward with a feeling of enjoyment, euphoria, and intensity that brings you into a state of being and awareness that could very well be called the other self. Our examination of the teachings of the sorcerer Don Juan would not be complete without mention of the loneliness that appears to be an inexorable condition of human beings. For average persons, loneliness is the most immediate expression of the unrealistic relationships that we have established with the world and with other people. We are surrounded by people in great numbers, family, friends, boss, subordinates, neighbors, but nevertheless are alone among them. We have been trained to possess, to use, to compete, to fear, to lie, and to hide, but not to encounter, to communicate, and to love. We arrange everything in order to stay separated. We are surrounded also by nature with myriad forms and colors, with trees and animals of all types, rivers, oceans, deserts, jungles, lakes, and mountains, a marvelous planet to inhabit, an infinite number of lights in the firmament of which to dream. Yet none of this affects us. We remain alone. We have learned that the world consists of many more or less inert things that were put here for our use. Our entire history appears to be nothing more than the gradual development of our capacity to use and exploit more and more the world of nature. A worldview such as this implies that we regard ourselves as being separate from nature. In the ancient Judeo-Christian tradition, as well in more recent theories of Marxism or the economic vision of the capitalist world, nature is to be dominated and exploited. Always Homo sapiens are the possessors of the earth, their relation with her one of use and exploitation. In encounters with indigenous communities, however, we have discovered that there are other ways of relating to the earth and to nature. For a Mexican Indian, the earth is not of people, but people are of the earth. Indigenous peoples of Toltec descent speak of corn as no nacatl, our flesh, expressing an awareness that the fruits of earth give us body and existence. Indigenous Nahuas of our time, here at the end of the millennium, still perform the ceremony of remembering the earth. This feeling of integration and non-separation brings the indigenous peoples of Mexico to love the earth as a conscious living being. The same feeling allowed the pre-Columbian civilizations of America to develop a science and technology that could very well be called ecological. This technology permitted them to develop, for example, large population centers, 30 million inhabitants in the central region of the country, without perceptible deterioration of the environment. Awareness of the earth as profound and incommensurable yields power and secrets to warriors when they put forgetfulness and personal history to one side and humbly open their spirit to her sweet presence. As Don Juan says, for a warrior there can be no greater love. Paradoxically, warriors also know what it means to be alone, since they are aware that their struggle is strictly their responsibility, each life a personal journey. But the solitude of warriors is of a nature very distinct from the solitude of loneliness experienced by an average person. It is not painful or full of need. It is experienced as a joyful secret that permits them to intensely love everything that they touch, look at, or feel. They know how quickly life passes and have learned how to love from the inexhaustible and disinterested love emanating from the earth. With devotion to the earth as the fundamental feeling, they establish an intimate and warm relationship with nature and with people. Thus, warriors express in their person that peculiar equilibrium between two poles of an apparently irresolvable contradiction. They are solitary beings who are never alone. Immersed in this contradiction, they are aware of aloneness, knowing that being alone is nothing more than a human concern having to do only with the tonal. They know, having been there, that there exists a reality beyond the apparent one, in which a human being is but a piece of light, hardly differentiated, and only for a brief instant, against the great fountain that is our origin and destiny, the earth. If you were to ask for an antidote to the anguish of human loneliness, we would suggest that you re-encounter and re-examine the connection that unites us with this earth, our lost umbilical cord. We would invite you to recognize the presence of an inexhaustible love that remains unaffected by human affairs. It is not so difficult. Look around, remember the being that sustains us, and realize you are at home, always at home. An infinite number of practices can serve to reconnect us with nature and with the earth. Anything will do, taking a walk, climbing a mountain, swimming a river, petting a dog, or hugging a human being, as long as our attention is focused on the encounter itself and not on its usefulness. We should visit natural environments often, taking great care to avoid damaging them, with our heart and attention wide open to listen to nature's message, to re-encounter also our own natural being. We should get away from the cities where human affairs destroy everything, and enter as often as possible into the world where everything occurs as it should. If we are attentive and perceptive, we can learn the rhythm of nature, the very rhythm we lack in our own lives. Many people have asked about masters. There is no master more knowledgeable than nature. It is quite enough to observe and imitate her. A particularly valuable technique is one called arboreal alpinism. This technique has to do with an activity that many of us knew as children and that we did only for fun, climbing trees. In this case, however, we will be dealing with something a little more elaborate. Our interest in trees arises from a personal experience upon encountering something much acknowledged in many ancient indigenous traditions, including Don Juan, the natural empathy that trees have for human beings. The exercise consists of climbing a tree and, once situated, practicing not doings to allow you to link yourself with the awareness of the tree. Any tree will do as long as its trunk and branches are strong enough to support your weight without fear of breakage. Also, your approach to the tree should be open and respectful. You must be extremely careful not to injure the tree in any way if you hope to establish a good relationship with it. Climbing the tree while maintaining alertness and concentration constitutes the basic exercise. The higher and more complicated the climb, the better. Find a place to rest among the high branches, learning to adjust body posture to their configuration. Practice merging your awareness with that of the tree, visualizing yourself as another branch of the tree, trying to assimilate its state of being, feeling and rocking with the wind. Observe the tree, taking note of the feelings that it produces in you. Form them into a song. Spend the night in a tree. Tell the tree your sorrows or what makes you happy, according to the circumstances. Another valuable exercise is referred to as the rhythm of the earth. This exercise is at once very easy and very difficult. Although the procedure is very simple, it requires a special state of being to carry out. The exercise consists of taking a hike, which can include alternately walking, jogging, or running. One fundamental aspect of this exercise is finding and maintaining the same rhythm in your pace, as well as in your breathing. They must remain synchronized. For this to be fully carried out, your rhythm must be assimilated from the rhythm of the earth. Only the earth can teach you her own rhythm. Your task is to achieve the connection. The hike should last several days, with the objective of simply walking and training the attention. Do not forget the earth at any moment. Remain aware that you are walking upon her. You can convert each step into a remembrance of the earth, caressing her with the feet without letting this affect in any way the natural way of walking. The longer you walk without interruption, the greater will be your chances for success, since the sharpening of the attention is one of the principal ingredients for achieving this link with the earth's awareness. When this occurs, you are no longer the walker moving yourself along. Rather, you are propelled by a force, what is known as the earth's boost, which can change your walk into an all-out run whose velocity can surpass all expectations. Needless to say, when this occurs, fatigue, time, and distance are parameters that no longer function. There is no room for speculation when this connection is made, since the feeling of being possessed by a power beyond the self is so overwhelming. Carlos Castaneda makes reference in different parts of his work to the practice of warriors burying themselves. He says that warriors bury themselves in the earth to find clarity, or to receive instructions, or to cure themselves of a malady. Although the procedure is too complex to describe here, it has many and varied effects, all beneficial on the practitioner. Yet another extremely useful exercise is one called a re-encounter with the earth. This exercise can serve as either a prelude or a finale to the other exercises detailed in this section. It deals with the intimate experience of a re-encounter with the earth, like the reunion of two beings who love each other, but haven't seen one another for a long time. For this reunion, choose a place that no one else knows about, a place that can remain a secret forever. You may know of a place beforehand, or you can go out and look for one. Preferably, it should be in a remote location. If reaching it requires a long walk or climb, so much the better. However, in reality, any place chosen for an appointment with the earth will do, since there is no way she will slight you by not responding to your encounter. Arriving at your place, lie face down on the earth, embracing her. You must feel and soak yourself in her presence. Then, still embracing and caressing her, begin to talk aloud to her, using intimate and personal words, telling her how grateful you are that she responded to your call and for always having been there. Explain to her the world from which you have come and why you had forgotten her. Tell her of those lonely moments of life when you did not remember her, of the lack you felt, and how happy this re-encounter makes you. Offer her one or two actions that you will carry out in the daily world that will help you remain aware of her presence and company. And finally, promise not to forget her again, but to love her until the moment arrives when she again takes you into her bosom to free you from all burdens. And last, give her a kiss and return to the world, immersed in her secret and loving embrace. To finish our discussion of the works and teachings of Carlos Castaneda, it may be helpful to add some considerations relating to the material presented. For many years, we have worked simultaneously with groups and in-field investigations using a new form of anthropology that we call anti-anthropology, offering new possibilities in the fields of psychology and psychotherapy, nourished by the encounter with nature and Toltec psychology. In our encounters with Toltec otherness, we have discovered that there are alternatives and that another way to live does exist. We truly can choose to make for ourselves a world and a life that exists in harmony with the aspirations of our spirit. It isn't easy, but it is possible. The truth is that achieving it requires us to detach ourselves from many of the habitual conceptions that we have assimilated from our society, and to recover parts of our being that society has encouraged us to forget altogether. As Don Juan said, inside each of us, there is hidden a sorcerer for whom we secretly yearn. We yearn for the magic, the mystery, and the freedom of that sorcerer.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.